Welcome to the Foresight Health Roundup podcast, Foresight Health's podcast series for healthcare revolutionaries. Outcomes matter, customers count, and value rules. Hello again, everyone. This is Dave Berta, news editor at Foresight Health. It is Thursday, July 24th. We're not going to talk about the Epstein files on today's show, but we are going to talk about the healthcare fallout from the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which is almost as criminal, with Dave Johnson, founder and CEO of Foresight Health, and Julie Murchison, partner at Transformation Capital. Hi, Dave. Hi, Julie. How are you two doing this morning? Dave?
Well, doing great. After we record this podcast, Terry and I are doing another U-Haul trip to Michigan to clear out more stuff from our Chicago house. You know, Dave, I think I've got what it takes to be a long-haul truck driver.
Yeah, you can go get your Class D license, right?
Exactly.
Good for you. Julie, how are you?
I'm quite pleasantly sitting at home every day working and enjoying the deck and just trying to live up summer. So I don't know. It's nice to be off the road, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. Travel gets weary. Okay, before we talk about the OBBB, let's talk about the OBBB. Dave, did you know that the OBBB's real name is the One Big Beautiful Bill Act?
Yeah, I did know that, Dave. It actually follows a pattern. Biden's two big legislative initiatives were the Build Back Better Act and the Inflation Reduction Act. You know, I'd rather they call them Kitchen Sink 1, Kitchen Sink 2, and Kitchen Sink 3. This reconciliation process is a terrible way to legislate.
Yeah. Julie, how about you? Did you know that was the actual name of the law?
You know, I did, but I can't with this. But I have to say, the word beautiful is interesting. You know, I don't think I've ever seen other administrations use words like that. So it is striking, to be honest. It's very different.
Yeah. Maybe I'm the only person who didn't know, because I didn't know till I wrote the script for the podcast. I thought it was Trump's nickname for something with budget or omnibus or reconciliation in the title. You know, the lack of decorum with this crowd is off the charts, right? I mean, what's next? Moving the Oval Office into Caesar's Palace? All right. Anyway, let's talk about the OBBB in the context of some recent objective bipartisan reports on the law's impact on healthcare. Let me give you some of the top line findings from three of them, and then I'll get your reaction. So don't spit out your coffee just yet. Here goes. The Congressional Budget Office released its final analysis of the law earlier this week. The CBO said the law would increase the number of people without health insurance by 10 million by 2034. The CBO also said the law would reduce budgeted federal health care spending by nearly $1.1 trillion by 2034. Last week, researchers from the universities of California, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina released an analysis of the health system impact of the law. Their analysis is based on an earlier but similar CBO analysis. It said the law would cause nearly 1,500 excess deaths, nearly 100,000 preventable hospitalizations, 1.6 million people delaying care because of the cost, 1.9 million cases of medication non-adherence, more than 100 rural hospitals to close, and increase unpaid medical bills by $7.6 billion. All that in just 9 years. Finally, last month, before Trump signed his bill into law, a report from the Urban Institute and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation said the bill at the time would increase uncompensated care spending by more than $200 billion, with $63 billion of that hitting hospitals and $24 billion of that hitting doctors. Again, all by 2034. This law is quite the high achiever. Dave, if you ran a health system, what are the two or three things you would be doing right now to prepare for all of this, assuming at least some of it will come true?
What do defense attorneys sometimes say at trial? The defense accepts the prosecutor's account of events. So the one big, beautiful bill is going to have a big negative impact on the healthcare industry along the lines you described. What's interesting to me, however, is despite Healthcare Inc. screaming at the top of their lungs about the proposed bill's catastrophic impact on the industry, the administration and Congress barely shrugged. You know, like the boy who cried wolf, it makes me wonder if the healthcare industry hasn't screamed crisis one time too many. Nobody's listening. Nobody cares. As my great friend Dan Lillenquist, Intermountain's chief strategy officer, says, and he actually said this when he was receiving the Richard C. Clark Award at the HFMA's annual meeting. That's, you know, I used to be on the board there. That's our most prestigious award. Dan was last year's recipient. And he got up and said, no one is riding to our rescue.
Wow.
We got to do it. We got to fix it ourselves. And I wonder if that truth is beginning to sink in. After his brother's assassination, Bobby Kennedy read ancient Greek poetry to try to make sense of it all. And just 2 months before his own assassination, announcing the death of MLK at a campaign event in Indianapolis. By the way, if you haven't seen that clip, it's one of the most remarkable things I've ever seen. There were no riots in Indianapolis after RFK made his speech. And among his comments there was this statement. My favorite poet was Aeschylus. He wrote, "In our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart until, in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God." Just think about that for a second. And is wisdom finally sinking into the hearts of health system administrators? I had a fantastic conversation this week with Ann Jordan, HFMA's CEO, and she told about three different conversations she had with health system CFOs regarding their organizational reactions to the one big, beautiful bill. One CFO's organization is doing an all-out PR campaign against the bill. Another is unemotionally diving into the numbers to make whatever adjustments they can to adapt. And the third said, we shouldn't be surprised. We did it to ourselves.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
The last CFO's statement contains Aeschylus-inspired wisdom. That is where salvation starts. It requires health system leaders to stop playing revenue cycle roulette and find ways to create value for their customers without raising prices. And in that sense, solutions must come from within. So, Dave, I didn't go into what I would do as CEO of a system, but the answers all lie within, and they require organizations to embrace value and consumerism and start creating the health system we all want to have.
Yeah, that's very powerful, Dave. Thank you. Julie, any questions for Dave?
Well, health systems are one of the largest, or maybe sometimes the largest employer in their region. And, you know, human labor economics is an enormous percent of their budgets. And just in the last week, I've heard like a handful of health systems laying off a significant number of people. So it's all kind of happening, and there'll definitely be more to come. So what kind of creative solutions do you think health systems have now that the writing is clear on the wall?
Yeah. You know, being a large employer is a political strength, a great political strength, but an economic weakness. Our healthcare system, Healthcare Inc., if you will, chooses to use its political and market leverage to perpetuate a high-cost centralized delivery system riddled with access and quality issues. And even beyond that, it treats end users like they're cogs on a conveyor belt. We talk about this every week, right? The appropriate response to all of this economic pressure is decentralized delivery that lowers costs, improves access, and delights customers. None of this is new. Virtual care, digital-first platforms, home-based service provision, tech-enabled diagnostics and preventive care. We know how to do all these things. And that's even before we get into the impact of Gen AI and its ability to eliminate kind of white collar jobs, of which there are enormous numbers in healthcare. So, Julie, I'd say it's not really what to do. We already know what to do. It's actually getting it done.
Yeah. Having the will to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's true. Thanks, Dave. All right, Julie, it is your turn with a twist. If you ran a healthcare technology company or a healthcare startup, what are the two or three things you would do right now to prepare for all of this? Again, assuming at least some of it will come true.
Well, Dave, for innovative companies, this is not all bad news. You know, I would definitely have my ear to the ground and I'd be thinking a lot about how we're going to adapt to certain situations. And obviously, some of these timelines in the OBBB, they sound long, but they're already hitting home. Like I said, I've seen a ton of layoffs and, you know, we're hearing from health systems that they are getting serious about certain innovations. So, okay, so I'm a CEO, right? I would definitely be reevaluating who I'm selling to and what their budget constraints are and what their Medicaid population is for sure. And obviously not all systems sit in a heavily Medicaid populated area. You know, you have places like Dallas that's kind of largely commercial and, you know, you have pockets that are very different. So I'd be thinking a lot about my regional strategy. And that, of course, you know, impacts your addressable market. You're going to have to, you know, what I am seeing, I think, Dave, to reinforce what you were saying, is that health systems feel like they have their backs up against the wall now a little bit more. And I was surprised by a couple of the systems I've talked to in the last few weeks who haven't been surprised by this bill. And not quite the same way that you talked about it, but there is kind of a reality check happening. So, you know, if I'm leading one of these companies, I'm going to ask myself, like, what can I do about our value prop that makes it really tangible? Can I attribute the savings that I can create in a really direct way, a way that I can prove? Can I create really material efficiencies that are hard dollar savings? I mean, that's really important. You hear health systems say that all the time, hard dollar savings. So figure out what that means and make it happen. And can I increase revenue with as little non-capital resources as possible? And by that, I really mean human labor. I talked to one very reputable health system that you would have thought could never feel the pain, I'll put it that way. And they're reeling from a layoff and from not being able to access anyone in the technology department for anything that needs to be integrated. I mean, it's like hair on fire situation. So I think if I'm a CEO of a solution company, I almost want to actually position myself more for the health systems that have been planning for this for a long time, because they're the ones that are ready to make this change. Some of the holier than thou, I don't ever need to really worry about my business model health systems. I think they're feeling a pain they haven't felt before. So I'd be really thoughtful about the market that way. But getting back to the business model part of it, you know, I'd look for outcomes that matter to providers. You know, you hear a lot of innovative companies today that talk about their ability to reduce admissions. Well,
yeah.
Most health systems don't want to hear that today unless there's some sort of revenue replacement strategy. So be thoughtful about who you're selling into. You know, as a small solution company, can't necessarily change the industry all by yourself. I know sometimes it seems like that, but so, you know, building these ROI models that are grounded in the real world are going to make a difference. And honestly, if I were in the Medicaid market today, it may feel challenging and look grim. And it's definitely shifting business models for some of those businesses. I mean, you know, this bill is shifting long-term Medicaid responsibility to the states. So the states, I think, are going to be more of a partner than a foe over the long run. It's just a matter of how you get through this short term. And, you know, where you can actually really be part of the new machine of serving Medicaid, you know, a smaller Medicaid population.
Yeah, prove the ROI, demonstrate hard dollar savings, and figure out the outcomes that matter to them without adding people. Yeah. Right? Oh, that's easy.
What happens when you look in the mirror and you think you're wearing a white hat and you're actually wearing a black hat? What does that feel like?
Yeah. Well, that's a good lead in. Dave, what's your official question? Not a rhetorical one. What do you got for Julie?
Julie, when does the financial pain get so great that hospitals shift away from cost shifting to value creation in order to square their accounting ledgers?
Well, you know, as I just said before, I do think the health systems have seen some of this coming, not this specifically necessarily, but a lot are better prepared. I still don't think those health systems are really thinking about the kinds of models that we talk about here. And you'll see, you know, some systems like Tampa General that are fiercely focused on their acute care business. I mean, it's kind of a mix. This gives health systems an opportunity to really define their business models, Dave. Do they want to be the broader, you know, end-to-end, or do they want to be like the best in particular specialties that are, you know, what we know are sitting in acute care hospitals today? So I think it's an opportunity to define themselves.
Excellent.
Now is the time, right?
The when? I don't know.
Exactly. Well, you know, if I were a healthcare journalist, which I am, what would I be doing right now, right? Well, I feel a great sense of job security, as I will have so many things to write about for the next 10 years. I'll be as busy as ever. So no retirement in sight, I'm afraid. I just can't walk away from this train wreck. So you guys are stuck with me for a while. So there you go. Okay, let's talk about what else happened in healthcare this week, as if this wasn't enough. Julie, what else happened this week that's worth noting?
Well, you know, on the private sector front, we are starting to see more and more M&A. So I do think, you know, you're seeing some of the RCM companies roll up. Dave, maybe there's something to that. You know, the machine is starting to move again. You can hear the wheels turning, which is good news. We saw Waystar, I think, is getting close to its acquisition of Iodine. That's the one I was focused on this week.
Dave, what other healthcare news should people know about?
Well, when it rains, it pours. Buried in last week's Medicare payment rule, the Trump administration included an accelerated clawback of Medicare's $7.8 billion overpayment in 340B programs. That all occurred during the first Trump administration. The AHA, not surprisingly, is considering a lawsuit. And so they're cutting it from 16 years to 6 years. So it's well over $1 billion a year impact. But as Dan Lillenquist said, no one is riding to hospitals' rescue. So it's just more pain added to the punishing mix of financial cuts that are being heaped on the industry right now.
They want their money back and they want it back now.
Yep.
All right. Thanks, Dave. And thanks, Julie. That is all the time we have for today. If you'd like to learn more about the topics we discussed on today's show, please visit our website at foresighthealth.com. You also can subscribe to The Roundup on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Don't miss another segment of the best 20 minutes in healthcare. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Berta, Foresight Health.